It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a jury verdict is expected in the case of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer accused in the death of George Floyd. We'll bring you live coverage of that jury announcement from NPR. First, the Biden administration faced backlash from advocates and some Democrats after it announced that it would maintain a lower cap for refugee resettlement here in the United States. President Biden originally signaled in February that the cap would be raised to more than 62,000 refugees, up from the historically low 15,000 limit put in place by the Trump administration. But last week, Biden signed an order extending the Trump-era cap through September. After criticism, the White House said it would reevaluate and announce a higher cap in mid-May. Our next guest joins us to talk about the state of refugees in the United States and the politics involved. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move from the Biden administration? What did you think of the lower cap on refugees started under the Trump administration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
Before we start digging into refugee policy, Elise, can we talk about who we're talking about here? I know it can be confusing to me. I'll say up front, who do we talk about when we're talking about refugees in particular?
Yeah, that's a great way to start the conversation. Under international law and U.S. law, refugees are a very narrow group that gets humanitarian protection because they are fleeing persecution, conflict, torture. So this does not include the domestic immigration discussion that we typically have about the southern border. Those people seeking asylum are asylum seekers, and under U.S. law, they go through a very different process and route. Whereas refugees through U.S. law are really coming through the United Nations Refugee Agency, and they're coming from overseas, and they often are going through a very lengthy vetting process, a year and a half, 2 years, even longer in some cases. So they are a very separate group from the asylum seekers that we think of when we think of the southern border.
And to lead up to this announcement on caps from the Biden administration, can you talk about the numbers of refugees admitted into the country and how that changed over the last few years?
Yes, well, for a long time, we had about an average of 80,000 refugees, those coming from overseas resettlement, per year. And again, that's an average. So it was times during the Cold War, much higher than that, you know, 140,000, 120,000. And then we saw in the Obama administration, it was roughly between 70 and 80,000 was the ceiling for overseas refugees. Now, during the Trump era, we saw that each year Trump lowered that cap. So that is how we got down from about 80, 70,000 all the way down to 15,000 by the end of Trump's administration.
And that takes us to this news now. What was your reaction to this initial statement from the Biden administration saying that for this current fiscal year that we're in, we would stay, if I have this right, at that 15,000 cap?
Yes, it's a little bit confusing because in some ways the administration set itself up, I think, for a backlash by saying that it was going to change the Trump fiscal year 2021 refugee cap. Now, the way refugee admissions work is by fiscal years, which can also be a bit confusing for us to understand. We're not used to thinking in those terms in our normal daily time. But the fiscal year starts every October and runs from October through September of the following year. So Biden did not have control over the initial refugee cap because that was set by Trump back in October of last year. And initially, he had just made the campaign promise when Biden was elected that he would be raising the ceiling up to 125,000 for fiscal year 2022. So that was sort of an interesting move that back in February, he said, well, actually, wait, I'm going to go ahead and use my power to intervene in the current refugee cap while we still have many months of the fiscal year left and get rid of that 15,000 and raise it up to 62,500.
Now, there was that backlash, and now the Biden administration is saying, okay, hold on, we're going to come out with a new number in mid-May. Now, for the people who had applied for refugee status, Is there a process in the works? Is there a waiting group of people to where if we change the number now, increase the number now, we would have people eligible and vetted to bring in as refugees?
Yes, that's a really great point, because a lot of the problems also came from the initial announcement in February that Biden was going to intervene in the fiscal 2021 and go ahead and raise it up to over 62,000. Well, then, of course, many refugee resettlement agencies moved forward, and many refugees that had been waiting in the so-called pipeline, as it's called, that had already been vetted, they were already cleared to travel to the United States, at least 35,000 or so were already, you know, ready. And then we saw all of these flights canceled. And then, of course, thousands of people that are waiting in very dangerous, unsafe conditions in oftentimes squalid refugee camps are just remaining in danger each day. Whereas previously, from the February announcement, they actually thought they were going to be gaining entry into the U.S. for their permanent resettlement.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW Green Bay about refugee resettlement in the United States and a sort of stop, start, and stop announcements from the Biden administration when it comes to increasing the cap for the current fiscal year that we're in. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Elise, where are the places in the world right now with large numbers of potential refugees waiting to come into the United States or other countries around the world?
Yeah, that's a really important global context. So right now, Syria remains the number one origin country. We're in the 10th year of conflict. It's hard to imagine, but we're in the 10th year of conflict in Syria, and currently Syrian refugees are over 40% of the global refugee resettlement needs. We also see Yemen, which is in its sixth year of civil war there. Over half of the Yemeni population is currently facing starvation. So that is a really grave humanitarian situation. And then we see Central American countries also have really spiked in terms of the number of refugees that have been vetted by the UNHCR, that's the refugee agency, as being in urgent need of resettlement. So those are some of the top countries of origin.
A lot of this from the United States perspective may have to do with domestic politics and people's thoughts about immigration. I've seen some analysts say, Elise, speculate anyway, that the Biden administration had held off on increasing the refugee numbers because of people's focus on the southern border and larger numbers of people arriving there seeking asylum. Do you see that as possibly something of a political trade-off going on here?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So there is this notion that there's a limited bandwidth during the first 100 days. And we know that the Biden administration has been really focused on vaccine distribution for the pandemic. And now, of course, with infrastructure legislation and a divided Congress, the notion that there's these political calculations at play saying, well, we can't do everything, and perhaps it will be divisive if we move forward with changing the refugee cap at this moment. So sort of putting that on the back burner. I don't think the administration was prepared for the backlash it would face, which in many ways, again, it kind of created this problem, I think, in the way it announced things and in the timing that it did so. But we do see that this is a very polarized issue, kind of a legacy of the Trump electoral cycle back in 2016. Refugees became very divisive, so that Democrats largely support refugee admissions now, and Republicans are much more likely to say they oppose refugee admissions, or at least want to greatly restrict the number of them.
We're talking to Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW Green Bay. She's with us to talk about the Biden administration's decision to pause the president's plan to increase the number of refugees it would admit to the United States, at least during this current fiscal year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the decision to maintain this lower cap in the number of refugees, then reevaluate it? Do you have questions about refugee status and what it means in the first place? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the Biden administration's stance on refugee resettlement with Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Green Bay. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about refugees and refugee status here in the United States and whether you want to see more or fewer people brought into the country as refugees. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Elise, can you talk about the vetting process you mentioned for refugees seeking to move here to the United States?
Yes, that's a very lengthy process, particularly after 9/11. We saw a reorganization with the Department of Homeland Security created, and the refugee vetting process really increased in length and rigor. So prior to Trump taking office and making changes, which further lengthened and delayed the vetting process, it was already about a year and a half to 2 years with multiple stages, interviews from specialized Homeland Security officers, very deep background checks. And then we saw when Trump came in, he enacted, or his administration enacted, further enhanced vetting, or what's been called extreme vetting procedures, which critics say is actually more of a redundancy. And those who supported it said it was really taking what was needed to prevent terrorist infiltration. So the Republicans that have opposed Biden's February announcement have kind of gone back to that Trump language of needing to return to a travel ban in some cases and needing to further lengthen the vetting, whereas those who were advocates of reducing it said, you know, it already took nearly 10 years or 2 years and was very thorough in that process.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, many years ago, there was a program, and you had to get a letter if you wanted your relative to come here as an immigrant. You had to get a letter from the United States Consul Office and show your bank account to show you would be and could be financially responsible for them. They don't do that anymore. But now we see on the news night after night that there's families here who are saying they want to and are ready to take their person in who's being detained at the border. And I'm just wondering, in that kind of case, when there's somebody here ready and willing to house and take care of their relative, why it is that those people don't have an express route out of detainment.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. And Elise, it sounds like Anita's referring more to asylum seekers at the southern border. I don't know if there was that a family voucher vouching for people seeking refugee status, but correct me, please, if I'm wrong.
Well, I think Anita's actually referring to many of the faith-based resettlement organizations that are playing a crucial role for the integration and welcoming once the refugees come and arrive from their flights from overseas. And in that case, Anita is correct. There are a lot of those voluntary and faith-based groups that are saying, you know, we are ready. We were under the impression back from February we would be taking in, you know, this family or helping with housing or, you know, helping them with getting integrated in their local community. And they said that we are ready to take them. And that has been one of the biggest pushes back is after that February announcement, many of those organizations and families that volunteer with them did make preparations and they are all set to receive, like I said, over 35,000 or so that were cleared to travel here. And so I think that's what Anita's getting at. And that's a really important point for the criticism of keeping that 15,000 and backtracking when the February announcement had already made preparations in play.
Anita, thanks a lot for that call. Go to Lynn next in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi. My comment is, years ago, I'm talking about 60s and 70s, we went into their country and we destroyed their way of government and their way of living. And it was all for political gain for us, the United States. I feel like if we want to do something about this problem, instead of at the border, we need to go back into the countries and straighten it out so that the gangs aren't taking over, so that they can make a decent living, so that they can exist in their own countries.
And Lynn, are you referring to Central American countries in particular, it sounds like?
Yes.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. And Elise, you and I have talked about this before in regard to people coming from the Central American countries, the ones just to the south of Mexico. What are your thoughts on what Lynn had to say?
Yeah, I think Lynn raises a really great point, not only with the U.S. history of intervention in Central America, which many of the legacies of that intervention remain as part of the driving forces why there's so much corruption and violence and types of persecution of not only Central America, even if we think of those countries I mentioned like Syria and Yemen that have some of the highest needs for global refugee resettlement. The U.S. also intervened in ways that created conditions of harm. A lot of the Syrian refugee situations and Syrian conflict were impacted by the Iraq war. And of course, with Yemen, that crisis has been impacted by the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia. So I think you can trace the kinds of threads that Lynn is bringing up to a lot of parts of the world where you could make an argument U.S. foreign policy and intervention has created an obligation to help the refugees in those cases.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lynn. In our last minute or so, Elise, we're talking about the current fiscal year. What are you watching for when the Biden administration has full control, in effect, of setting that refugee standard as opposed to just half the fiscal year or so?
Yes, it will be interesting now that they have experienced this backlash if they will make sure they stick to the campaign promise that for fiscal year 2022, it would be 125,000 as the refugee admission ceiling. And how maybe even in May, like they said in May, they might further increase the current fiscal year to go above that 15,000 number. So I'll be watching that and kind of seeing how they conflate it with the asylum seeking situation at the southern border versus how they kind of more accurately distinguish that overseas refugees are a very different process.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks. It was great to be with you, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She joined us today to talk about the Biden administration's decision to cap the number of refugees at the historically lower level set by the Trump administration. Now, after some backlash, the Biden administration says it will release a higher cap in mid-May. A new therapy technique at Wisconsin's Lincoln Hills Youth Prison holds the promise of making the facility safer for both guards and youth. But implementing it will take buy-in from the staff, and advocates for youth justice reform say it's no substitute for the state's promise to close Lincoln Hills for good. Rob Mentzer has more.
In 2015, a state investigation found a supervisor at Wisconsin's youth prison sprayed an inmate in the face with pepper spray, then told staffers to falsify their reports. That same year, an investigator recommended charges against a guard who put his hand on the neck of a 15-year-old girl. There were scores of such incidents investigated by the state and the FBI at Lincoln Hills School. Some staffers were fired, some resigned or retired as the probe was going on. By 2018, state legislators voted to close the troubled facility, setting a deadline of January 2021. But Lincoln Hills hasn't closed, and it's not clear it will close anytime soon.
I'm not the one that is going to make that decision, but I know it's not closed. And if it's not closed, I want to do everything that I can to make it a treatment-focused facility.
Psychologist Leslie Chapin is leading a new effort to change the way staff and youth at Lincoln Hills interact. It's called Dialectical Behavior Therapy, or DBT. It emphasizes communication and relationships over punitive approaches.
We need good relationships in order for the treatment to work.
DBT is backed by research finding the therapy can make institutions safer for both inmates and staff. In January, an independent monitor wrote that she was encouraged by the progress and commitment to implementing DBT at Lincoln Hills. But it's very different from what staff and inmates there are used to. Donna Villafane was sent to the youth prison several years ago after she was arrested for stealing a car. The now 18-year-old says her two stints at the facility were rough.
It didn't impact me in a way where I'm like, okay, I want to change my life around. It impacted me in a negative way. I was angry in there.
Villafane says she had some good relationships with staff members when she was at the prison, but there were others who taunted and insulted her.
They have so many programs there. They all got trained for it. None of it worked. They don't listen. The staff do what they want to do. In their eyes, we do what we want to do.
State leaders don't completely disagree. Implementing the new technique will require a culture shift, says Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr.
I have a lot of faith in our staff and a lot of respect for their abilities to be adaptable and learn new skills. They'll be able to make this transition. It's just going to take some time.
And buy-in. A staff member who wasn't authorized to speak publicly told WPR that many who work there are skeptical of the approach. They think changes made in the last few years have made Lincoln Hills less safe for staff. And for advocates of youth justice reform, a new approach to therapy just isn't enough change. Charlene Moore of the Milwaukee-based nonprofit Urban Underground says the facility has to be closed.
We have to put more resources on the preventative side and not just when a young person gets in trouble. And we say, well, you know what? We got a really nice jail for you. It's brand new. You know, we got sunlight coming through the skylight. Like, you know, we got to start looking at it very differently.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Erica, and thanks, everybody, for being here on such a beautiful day.
In his proposed state budget, Governor Tony Evers revives the plan for closing Lincoln Hills in favor of several smaller youth facilities around the state. At an event in Milwaukee last week, he highlighted this and other youth criminal justice reforms.
Wisconsin is ready to make this change, and that's why I'm glad to be here today with advocates and leaders on this issue.
In 2019, Republicans in the legislature left out funding for the restructure, which was originally championed by Republican Governor Scott Walker. Vincent Schiraldi is director of Columbia University's Justice Lab. He says it's hard in a place like Lincoln Hills to make any reforms stick.
So in the meantime, it's probably good to have good therapy programs going on in such facilities, but we should not mistake that for the notion that somehow Wisconsin's going to come up with a way to fix the unfixable.
Lawmakers will consider Governor Evers' budget proposal in coming months. The next deadline set by the legislature to close Lincoln Hills is July 1st. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. In just a few moments, we'll turn to breaking news coverage. The jury in the Derek Chauvin trial has reached a verdict. We're going to be turning to them now to get the ruling and live coverage of that ruling from NPR. Chauvin was facing charges of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. We'll get that live coverage. Then, coming up at 4, we'll get analysis of the verdict with a law professor in the Minneapolis area, and you can join in with your reactions. That's all coming up this afternoon here on Central Time.